You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of November 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear...
I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear...
...that I will faithfully execute...
...that I will faithfully execute...
...the office of President of the United States.
Not for a third time he won't. On today's show, Martin Plaut and James Boyes will whip out the presidential crystal ball to begin the two-year task of identifying the next occupant of the White House. We'll also discuss the worsening situation in Libya, whether Nigeria is right to blame the US for its failures against Boko Haram, and by way of light relief...
The winner to organize the 2022 FIFA World Cup is Qatar!
FIFA exonerates itself of any shabby dealing in its awarding of the 2022 World Cup to about the least hospitable location outside North Korea, where they at least play football. Among those unconvinced, however, is FIFA's own investigator. We'll also see what New York's weekly magazines have seen fit to print, figure out exactly what a creative director brings to a company, and review the week's best new books. That's all to come on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So loads coming up in the next 58 and a quarter minutes. But before all of that, Jonathan Wheatley has the latest world news.
Clinical trials of three potential Ebola treatments will begin in December in Guinea and Liberia at medical centres run by Médecins Sans Frontières, the medical charity said today. Annick Antiaren, a doctor who coordinates MSF's investigational partnerships, spoke on the latest developments at a news conference in Geneva.
So there's going to be two off-label antiviral drugs. One is called favipiravir. It's from Fuji from Japan. And the other one is brincidofovir from Chimerix USA. They're both antiviral drugs that were used against other infections, other viral infections, but not against Ebola. And then there is a third therapeutic product, which is convalescent blood and convalescent plasma, which has been used in the past, but without very good data.
The results won't be available until February next year. Moscow and Kiev have traded accusations today for failing to observe a ceasefire agreement, and Russia warned a resumption of hostilities against pro-Russian separatists in the east would be catastrophic for Ukraine. Ukraine accused Russia of sending soldiers and weapons to help rebels launch a new offensive in a conflict that's already killed more than 4,000 people. Increasing violence, ceasefire violations, and reports of unmarked armed convoys travelling from the direction of the Russian border have boosted fears that a shaky 5th of September truce could collapse. The Israeli government says it will not cooperate with the United Nations Commission investigating the Gaza conflict earlier this year. The Foreign Ministry has accused the head of the commission, William Skakabas, of anti-Israeli bias. Ministry spokesman is Emmanuel Nashon.
The Shavas Commission is the modern-day equivalent of the KGB trials or the Star Chamber. First, they shoot the arrow, and then they would like to draw the aim, and it is clear that the aim is to be as anti-Israeli as possible. We are talking about a commission which is totally illegitimate, which was appointed by an anti-Israeli body with a mandate which is clearly against Israel. They had no intention of really checking what happened in Gaza.
Islamic State has released an audio tape it says was recorded by its leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi days after reports that he had been killed or injured. In the recording, the speaker says IS fighters will never cease fighting, even if only one soldier remains. Correspondents say the recording appears authentic and recent. Reports said that Baghdadi had been badly injured following US-led airstrikes near the Iraqi city of Mosul last week. The team behind the first successful landing on a comet says the probe is secure. Harpoons meant to attach Philae to the comet failed to fire properly when it landed, but Mission Control says communications today show it is stable. Mission scientist Stefan Ulamek says they've also learnt that the probe bounced several times before it actually landed.
We came in with about 1 meter per second, and then we rebounced with about 38 centimeter per second. Had a 2 hours jump. Probably up to 1 kilometer. probably also around 1 kilometer distance, and this makes it difficult to find out where we are now.
And finally, cave researchers in Austria have stumbled across the skeleton of a skier who apparently fell to his death many decades ago. Geologist Georg Zagler made the grisly discovery while exploring the alpine site on Untersberg's peak near Salzburg. A recovery team have now brought out the remains. And that's latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York City. Joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio are Martin Plaut from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies at the University of London and James Boyes, political historian and author of the book Clinton's Grand Strategy, Hillary Clinton, that is. Welcome both to the programme. We will start in Libya, which is currently enduring a grim week even by the beleaguered country's recent standards. Earlier this week, three young social media activists were found beheaded in the eastern city of Derna. Today, a car bomb has been detonated outside the Egyptian embassy in Tripoli, causing no injuries, and another failed to detonate outside the embassy of the United Arab Emirates. Martin, both these embassies, like most embassies and most foreign legations, officers, delegations, deputations in Tripoli, have been closed for months. What would be the point of this?
Well, I think people are just showing what they're capable of and indicating the kind of targets that they wish to attack, and they no doubt wish they were there. I mean, the Americans certainly pulled out ages ago. They're not having anything else there. I mean, the government has essentially, you know, disappeared from the town. It's now holed up in Misrata and Tobruk, and frankly doesn't control more than a hill of beans.
The motivations behind it's probably not that difficult to discern. Both the UAE and Egypt have sent aircraft up on semi-denied missions to bomb Islamist positions around Tripoli. James, trying to figure out what's going on in Libya, especially at this distance, actually I suspect up close, granted that it's something of a fool's errand, but is it possible to have any idea who actually did this?
It's probably a little early to tell at this point. I'm sure there are a variety of usual suspects we could look at. But one thing it does bear out is that, you know, who would want to be working in an embassy in Libya at this point? You know, one is immediately reminded of the Benghazi incident, for example, which I think we're going to be hearing an awful lot more about as we move into the 2016 presidential election. I think what you can say for certain is that whatever hopes we had for the Arab Spring have now been completely put away with. I'm honoured to teach a number of Libyan students at my university, and what they do tell me is that whatever one thought of Colonel Gaddafi in the West, at least there was a sense of someone in control there now. They, as women in that part of the world, feel very threatened. You're seeing an exodus from the country in terms of the intelligentsia, and so any a sense that anything good is going to come out of this current situation, I think, is very difficult to see at this point.
What you point out there is the absolutely heartbreaking irony of the whole thing. I visited Libya very briefly during Colonel Gaddafi's rule, and it was as most dictatorships are, it was a dreadfully dreary, dull and miserable place. But the idea that it's now by an order of magnitude worse. Do your students, though, just to pick up on that point, do they still think of Libya as actually a coherent, cohesive country, which they feel like is their home?
What they do say is that, you know, they obviously have an emotional attachment to the land and to the nation. But what they are saying is that it is a very difficult place to live in now. Moving around is very difficult. I should point out that I'm talking about Libyan women at this point, young student age women in 18, 19, 20 year olds. You know, the idea that it's difficult to move around, that they have to very much be aware of their environment in a way that they never had to before, they were saying. The ability to leave the country becomes difficult in terms of going in and out of Tripoli, for example. Decisions to use private airfields, for example. It's a much more difficult place to live now than it ever was before, irrespective of whatever you used to think of from a Western perspective of the pros or cons of the mad dog colonel.
You could certainly, under his rule, it does have to be said, you could walk home after dark without any particular worry for your own safety. But at that point, you start to get a bit into the realm of he made the trains run on time variety arguments. And Martin, as you pointed out, there is now one government in Tobruk, another one in Tripoli, neither of which appear to actually govern anything terribly much. Is there any measurement we can think of by which Libya isn't a failed state at this point?
Well, I suppose you might say that it's not quite as bad as Somalia at its worst.
But that's not a line you put on the posters, is it?
It certainly isn't. But I mean, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I suppose the country is falling back into its constituent parts. You basically have tribal groups, and then you have what one shouldn't forget is that you know, Gaddafi did one thing, which was to bring together a pan-African, pan-Arab army, also including Africans, from across the whole of the Sahel, and said, anybody can fight for me. Now, those people, some of them went home taking weapons with them, which is one of the reasons why, you know, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb is quite well armed. But others of them stayed. And they have, some of those, become members of these various factions, these various warlord groups. So, I mean, you know, how does one decipher any of this? It's exceptionally difficult.
The colonel was, of course, unloaded with a certain measure of help from Western Air Forces and doubtless Western Special Forces guiding those Western Air Forces. Do we still owe Libya anything? Ask you first, Martin. Is there anything the Western world could or should do, or have we now reached the point where anything that we do try to do in intervening in Arab countries is just going to make things even worse than they already are?
Yes, I think that is certainly true. I mean, look at our attempts to do something in Syria. I mean, what have we done? Almost nothing. There's been, you know, it's hard to see what impact we've had except come in too late. And, you know, we've done nothing about the UAE and Qatar, who are basically up to their necks in places like Syria. So, you know, we don't deal with the things we could deal with, and we leave these countries in a mess. It's appalling.
James, you have written an entire book about American foreign policy, at least as seen by its last Secretary of State, but one. From America's point of view, though, would America be thinking, and this is about as cynical and grotesque as real politic gets, would they just be looking at Libya and thinking, really, what's this got to do with us? Why is this our problem?
Well, first of all, the book's actually about Bill Clinton's foreign policy, but that's all right. But what is interesting with regard to that is the way in which at least Bill Clinton, when he talked about democratic promotion, tried to do so in quite a nuanced fashion, in contrast, for example, to the rather more muscular approach that George W. Bush took of trying to actively export democracy and get behind this idea of, you know, deliberately taking democracy to other parts of the world and forcibly applying it to places like Iraq, for example. So I think what you've seen is a pattern, a movement away from a rather nuanced attempt to try and impose democracy to a muscular approach under George W. Bush, under Barack Obama, very much a walking away from that, because whatever one says about the US intervention or lack thereof within the Arab Spring, there was this accusation that the US was leading from behind, quite famously, that we were in the West awaiting invitations from that part of the world, that we were very happy to let nations of that part of the world and other nations like France, for example, and Britain to an extent, take the lead with regard to some military action. Ultimately, what can we do? I think there has been a recognition in Washington that the ability to enact serious change in that part of the world is very, very difficult. It's not as simple as certain think tanks in Washington might like to prescribe, and that really whatever the West does in that part of the world is going to come up flawed. You intervene, it becomes problematic, we break it, we own it. We don't intervene, all of a sudden it's our fault. Same thing with what's going on with Nigeria, with either not supplying arms. The US is damned if it does and damned if it doesn't.
Well, you mentioned that, James, you mentioned Nigeria there, and we will move along to that unhappy subject now. This is, of course, slightly further south from Libya, where Nigeria's war with the Islamist insurgency Boko Haram has prompted a minor diplomatic incident, easy for me to say. Nigeria's ambassador to the United States, Ade Adefoye, has accused Washington of being parsimonious with arms supplies due to concerns about the human rights record of the Nigerian military. This comes a few days after a Boko Haram suicide bomber killed 46 schoolboys in Yobe State. James, I'll ask you first, is this basically the Nigerian government manoeuvring to blame America for their own failures in dealing with this problem?
Yeah, I think pretty much. It's quite a shock, isn't it? Here we are talking about a story about the United States not selling arms to a nation.
This is the damned if you do, damned
if
you don't.
Yeah, absolutely right. You know, it's one of the reasons I wanted to mention it, because I knew we were coming on to this idea that, you know, cracking out loud, you know, the United States has always been accused of being the world's largest arms sailor, of dealing death and destruction, and almost dishing the stuff out willy-nilly. really, quite frankly.
No, they're nothing compared with the Soviet Union, of course.
Well, of course. They are, well, defunct now, so I guess the United States is very much taking the lead on that. But here we are talking about a story whereby the United States, under Obama, a president I've been ill-prepared to praise for many, many reasons, is now saying, we are not selling arms to you because of your human rights record. You would think that's something that would make a good news story, but here all of a sudden it's being flipped around. Oh my goodness, Boko Haram, you know, this organization which Michelle Obama famously put that sign up, the hashtag, bring the, back the girls, and that was about as extensive as the US response was going to get to that. There's a lovely statement here, I think, from one of the representatives from Nigeria saying, a friend in need is a friend indeed. I think another line of that is, the enemy of my enemy is my friend in this case, quite frankly.
It is obviously one of those things that demonstrates what an absolutely rotten job being president of the United States is, and we will come to the potential next holder of that ghastly position shortly. Martin, the ambassador to Washington further goes on to state that the human rights abuses that are so vexing the American government, were in fact committed by Boko Haram members in stolen Nigerian uniforms. Is
it remotely plausible? Not even remotely. And let me just correct one point which James made, which is that the United States has done nothing apart from, you know, denying arms. I mean, they have actually put special forces in there and have tried to do something to try and find these girls, which is a damn sight more than the Nigerian army has done, which has frankly just run away from anything. So, I mean, that has been their contribution. But let me, there's something we're missing here, which is, it isn't just America that's not doing this. The South Africans have also refused to sell weapons to the Nigerians. And if you think that the Nigerians are angry with the Americans, they are absolutely spitting blood at the South Africans because they say, you know, you're on our continent. You know, so what are you doing? You're turning your backs on, you know, other Africans. But of course, everybody knows why they're not doing this. And this is because of the absolutely atrocious human rights record of the Nigerian army. Do you want your guns to be killing innocent men, women and children? Because it's damn sight easier for the Nigerian army to kill innocent men, women and children than to take on Boko Haram, which, so that's what they do.
Is it possible that, and again, this is one of those things that nobody likes to countenance, especially not in the case of something clearly as ghastly as the Boko Haram insurgency is it actually practically an unsolvable problem? Is this something they control a vast swath of territory at this point? It's quite difficult territory to reach. They're very diffuse, they're very scattered, they're very mobile. Is this actually something any military, never mind Nigeria's, can actually deal with?
There is no problem on earth that cannot be solved. That, you know, it just isn't true that you can't solve it. But you have to tackle these things at the root. You have to improve the development of the north of Nigeria, and you have to cut the weapons that are coming through Chad. Why do you think there's no trouble in Chad? Because Chad is the way that that arms and money are coming in through from the Gulf. That is where Boko Haram is getting their support from. It's the same kind of people who are supporting Boko Haram that are supporting Islamic State in Iraq and in Syria. So you have to cut the source there. Then you have to deal with the developmental issues, and you have to deal with the human rights and abuses of your own army. Train them up properly. This is a massive agenda, but it's not impossible.
James, again, seeing how this would be seen from the White House, mm-hmm. and as you said, you've not been a huge fan of Barack Obama's somewhat diffident foreign policy, but is this exactly that? Is this a situation that a pragmatic, thoughtful, sensible chap such as himself just looks at and thinks, I can't win here?
Yeah, but I think that's been U.S. foreign policy towards Africa pretty much since the early days of the Clinton administration with regard to what happened in Somalia. And we were mentioning Somalia beforehand. Let's return to it one more time. The idea that, in the words of Mark Bowden, you know, they've written themselves off the map, effectively. You've seen a hesitancy to get involved in Africa for a variety of reasons, not least of which is the fact that, you know, where is the domestic constituency advocating any national interest in that part of the world? You know, we often talk about the influence of other nations upon Capitol Hill, for example, but there is no great African lobby necessarily pushing for US intervention, be it militarily or economic, in that part of the world. Now, that's not to say it hasn't happened. And of course, George W. Bush, either famously or not known at all in many respects, did an awful lot for Africa in terms of pumping a lot of money into AIDS research, for example. But, you know, in terms of a long-term strategic interest in that part of the world, the United States really has taken a back seat for much much of the last 20 years. And as a result, you're not going to see any great push to do an awful lot there. Martin's absolutely right. The US under Obama has put a relatively light footprint of special forces into there and particularly used North African states for staging posts for its aerial drone facility, for example. But, you know, the idea that you can see an American intervention on the African continent anytime soon, I think, is really something that isn't going to happen.
Let me disagree with that. I think that's simply not true. Under Obama, there has been a much greater involvement, and quite frankly, it is military as well. One shouldn't overlook what's going on in Djibouti and the way that the Americans are extending their presence over the whole of the Horn of Africa. And those are not just small drone bases; they're getting bigger. And I would bet you, look at what the Americans' military is now doing in Liberia. They're putting $1 billion in over 2 years. And if you think that is only going to be to build up the ability to fight Ebola, I would be amazed. Now, I might be wrong about that, but Ellen Johnson Sirleaf was very keen to have an American base on her soil, and I think that is where we're going. The Americans are much more involved in Africa, military and politically, than anybody gives them credit for. I mean, you know, Obama has held a summit for African leaders that is now designed to counter the same kind of summit that the Chinese have been holding. I think there's much more robust a relationship with Africa than he's given credit for.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Martin Plout and James Boyce. When we return, we will start the parlor game likely to dominate the next 2 years of American politics, guessing the identity of the 45th President of the United States.
As the day draws down in Europe and the next morning begins in Asia, the Monocle Daily is on hand to bring you up to speed with a one-hour programme packed with news, business and the best culture and design stories from around the world. Our presenting team in London are joined by guests in Monocle's New York and Toronto studios.
There's lots that the US and the international community can do, but it's enfeebled by its diplomatic and political shortcomings.
And as the sun rises from Tokyo to Sydney, we'll take a look at some of the more interesting front pages landing on doorsteps across the region.
The authority of the Chinese Communist Party has been challenged on its doorstep in Hong Kong, and they do not like it.
That's the Monocle Daily, every weekday at 2200 hours London time, in association with UBS.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with us are Martin Plout from the Institute of Commonwealth Studies and the US political historian James Boyce. Now, 5 days short of 2 years from today, Americans will elect a new president. If the bookmakers are to be believed, not only the Democratic nomination, but the White House are Hillary Clinton's to lose. So for any Democratic contender, the challenge is to come up with a reason why Clinton should be deprived of her long-telegraphed date with destiny. The Republicans, meanwhile, face the daunting reality that running as the party of angry old straight white men no longer gets out the necessary numbers. James, let's look at Hillary first. Is she that nailed on a favourite? Is there another Democratic contender? I have a printout of bookmakers' odds here. The nearest Democrat to Hillary,
yep,
who you can only get 5-4 on,
okay,
is Elizabeth Warren yep, at 14s.
Yep. And the reason for that is as simple as this. The Democratic Party are very, very concerned that it appears that they're going to have a coronation. And they desperately want to have a contest.
It wouldn't just be a coronation. It would be a return to swapping the presidency between two families for what would become a bizarrely long period of American history.
It would be bizarre, as you rightly point out. But here's the thing. The thing that's going to potentially cost Hillary Clinton the presidency is getting the Democratic nomination. Because I think, just as in 2008, whoever gets the Democratic nomination is likely to win the presidency. She's got to get that nomination first. And I think there's too many people in Europe, for example, who are assuming that's in the bag, and it ain't. Because the Democratic Party itself could well prove the impediment that she can't overcome. Just as in 2008, she couldn't overcome Barack Obama, just because there were certain people in the Democratic Party who were determined to make life difficult for her. Fundamentally, the Clintons are not beloved within the Democratic Party because they are not liberal enough.
But also Obama, in Obama there was an alternative. There was a fantastic candidate in many respects in Barack Obama. After Elizabeth Warren, the nearest runner is Joe Biden at 33-1, and you can't see that, surely.
Uncle Joe is going to be very, very difficult to see him taking the lead and getting beyond Hillary at this point. Hillary's got so much money in the bank, she's got the ground game down. She's a known force, and that is both good and bad, because all the problems with all of the candidates going into 2016 is they are their own worst enemies. They all bring so much baggage, and none more so than Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Martin Plaut, the shortest priced Republican favourite, proving that, you know, things change, things stay the same. Jeb Bush at 8-1. Is that surname a help or a hindrance at this point, do you think? It's very hard to say.
I mean, he's somebody that I would, you know, went blanched to back, even if I had to put my money on it. I mean, you know, the Bush family has run two presidencies, and, you know, neither of them were as bad, I think, as people in Europe think they were.
That's true.
And, you know, I think he has a worse reputation outside of America than he does inside. But, you know, America's a strange place. I don't even pretend to understand it. you know, I've been there, you know, must be half a dozen times. Let me give you one example. Years ago, I had a couple of days off. It was after 9/11, and everybody's wearing the flag. And I tried to go and do a few vox pops with ordinary Americans about why they were wearing the flag. Just ordinary vox pops. I was just asking why you do it. And, you know, I nearly got beaten up. And I just, you know, I don't understand this place.
If that was in New York or...
Yeah, it was in Washington.
Right, okay. I think it's important to recognise the massive trauma that event have had upon the nation, to be quite honest, and that's something that really needs to be considered. But with regard to Jeb Bush, this idea that he's going to be damned because of his association with W is unfortunate, because just take it back to 1994. In that election cycle, the expectation was that Jeb was going to win the governorship of Florida. He was the smart, more intelligent son of the former president, and that George W. would lose the governorship in Texas. Through a strange series of events, the exact opposite happened, which is what propelled W. to the forefront in 2000. Jeb Bush was known to have run in a very infective governorship of Florida during his time in office there, for example. I don't think most people who know Jeb Bush would question his competence or ability to be president. What will hold him back is his diffidence. I think it's very clear that he has very serious doubts about whether he wants to be president. He's seen the effect it can have upon his father, who, of course, was turfed out after one term, despite being on paper the most qualified president, if not in American history, perhaps, then certainly in the 20th century. And it's seen the massive impact it had on his brother, who, of course, left office with opinion poll ratings in the low 20s. I think there's been an attempt in recent times to try to massage the Bush family record. You've seen a lot going on in the last week with regard to the new memoir that George W. Bush has put out about his father. It's clearly an attempt, I think, to try to soften the image of the family. Whether it will work, we'll have to wait and see.
Okay, well, final thought on this one. I like the 50-1 you can get on Susana Martinez, Republican governor of New Mexico. Seriously, and I speak as the person who, though I was stupid and didn't put money on it at the time, I did see Sarah Palin coming.
Congratulations.
Oh, well done.
You take your money, you place your chances.
I really, really wish I'd put money on it. But anyway, finally, the light relief part of this afternoon's discussion. When FIFA awarded the 2018 World Cup to Russia and the 2022 Cup to Qatar, there were a few embittered cynics who suggested that something seemed somewhat fishy about the awarding a football showpiece tournament to, respectively, a chronically corrupt and incompetent quasi-autocracy and a baking desert with no native football culture but a bottomless pit of money. Now, happily, an investigation into FIFA by FIFA has concluded that the entire process was absolutely above board. Martin, I'll ask you first. Are we reassured by this?
Absolutely. We're completely convinced. Mr. Eckhard is right. How can you possibly doubt it? I mean, the fact that the lawyer, Mr. Garcia, who actually did the investigation, called it a whitewash and misrepresentation of his entire report. You just don't understand these things. You know, let me put it to you this way. A friend of mine did a lot of work on FIFA many years ago, and I began to talk to him about it, and he just became puce in the face. And this was at least 5 years ago, maybe 7 years ago. He said, this organisation is, and well, he used words that I couldn't possibly use on air.
the thing that astonishes me, James, and it's almost impressive about FIFA. They don't care.
No, absolutely not. I mean, and until Sepp Blatter steps down, we're never going to get anywhere. Listen, I grew up in this country. I, you know, started kicking a football against the wall when I was 7 and never stopped until I was about 17, I guess. So, love the sport. I've actually stopped watching it. I'm so convinced that it's just a complete bunch of crooks, quite frankly, from the top down. Sepp Blatter is setting a standard which really needs to be removed from the game. The fact that Michael Garcia has basically taken his name away from this and basically said, look, it's a complete fabrication, it misrepresents his conclusions. The fact also that they've come out and basically say, oh, we're going to clear Qatar and Russia, but guess what? The Brits are up to no good.
that was obvious.
That was a lovely touch. P.S. Yabu sucks England.
Absolutely. And it comes down to a battle of wills between Jack Warner and Sepp Blatter, I think, and England's been on the wrong side, I think, of that contest.
I think we will leave the last word on this to the FA chairman, Greg Dyke, who was asked earlier today whether he thought this was going to damage the image of FIFA. He replied, I think it's quite hard to damage the image of FIFA. We Absolutely. Will have to leave it there. Martin Plout and James Boyce, thank you both very much for joining us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Монако 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Дете е Монако 24.
Лондонист, Нью Йоркист, Токиост. Се е Монако 24.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Монако 24 дес.
Лондино, Нью Йорк, Токио.
This is Monako 24.
And there's loads still coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be off to New York City to catch up with Monocle's Tristan McAllister to see what's in the weekly magazines. And we'll be reviewing the week's best new book releases, among much else. Ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. Clinical trials for 3 potential Ebola treatments will begin in December in Guinea and Liberia at medical centres run by Médecins Sans Frontières, the medical charity said today, but the results won't be available until February next year. Moscow and Kiev have traded accusations today for failing to observe a ceasefire agreement, and Russia warned a resumption of hostilities against pro-Russian separatists in the east would be catastrophic for Ukraine. The Israeli government says it won't cooperate with the UN commission investigating the Gaza conflict early this year. The foreign ministry has accused the head of that commission of anti-Israeli bias. An Islamic State has released an audio tape, it says, was recorded by its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, days after reports that he'd been killed or injured. In the recording, the speaker says IS fighters will never cease fighting, even if only one soldier remains. And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House live on Monocle 24. It's 21:33 near enough in Moscow. That's 18:33 in London, 13:33 in New York. It's that part of the program, a relatively new addition to the lineup, where we take a closer look at stories that are making the newsstands in the weekly magazines. Today we're going to New York City, where Monocle's Tristan McAllister has been leafing through to find some of the stories that the US media are focusing on. Tristan, what do you want to start with?
Well, I think something that should be maybe front and center is this discussion around the movie Interstellar. It's on the cover of Wired magazine. Now, Wired, of course, put out this magazine, and they're featuring Disney and Pixar, of course, the well-known animation studio, but they're also talking about the science behind the movie Interstellar.
And what have they discovered about it? Interstellar obviously is a huge production starring Matthew McConaughey as the person who is going, as I understand it, lead humanity to salvation.
Yep.
Really, that it would come to that. But what do we actually learn about the production of the film?
Well, and first of all, I've seen the film. It's very interesting, and your mind just does wonder whether or not the science makes sense. And indeed, what most people are saying is that the science does make sense in a lot of ways. What is interesting about the film, though, and what is sort of deconstructed in this article in Wired, has a lot to do with the fact that a lot of what they put on screen had never really been visualized before. So they literally spent just so many hours making sure that these things were accurate, but they were accurate based on concept, not on what would really be a visual confirmation. So all the scientists are now saying, yes, this in theory is what it would look like, but even the scientists didn't really know what it would look like. So that's pretty interesting to me.
See, I'm quite surprised and kind of impressed that that much research goes into it, because I would have thought that the whole point, or at least one of the whole points of making any sort of science fiction narrative, is that you can just basically make stuff up. It doesn't really matter whether it makes any sense or not.
Right, and I think that's one of the things that a lot of people are saying, is that you have to suspend your disbelief when you walk into a theater and you see a movie about time and space travel and, like, you know, future sort of doomsday plots. You just sort of have to let it go. There are holes in the plot. There are things that don't make sense, but the
surely
things
not.
That do make sense. Yeah. But the things that do make sense are the visuals, according to a lot of these scientists.
Okay, well, let's move along to what the New Yorker has on the front. They've got one of their less subtle cartoons depicting a large elephant perched in the Oval Office, sort of staring down its current occupant. I think we can see what we've done there. But what's actually in the magazine?
Well, you know, it's the New Yorker, true to form, doesn't necessarily, sometimes the articles in the magazine aren't specifically about what's on the cover. I think it's a little more thematic at this point. First of all, it we're referring to the election that just took place here, where the Democrats essentially got walloped, but also talking about what's going to happen in 2016 with Hillary Clinton. Of course, not a subtle cover, as you pointed out, but still, you know, the underlying thing here, and what I think is sort of interesting thematically, and what is pointed out in the magazine, is that, you know, under this president, We are now seeing a good economy, one of the fastest growing in the industrialized world. We're seeing low petrol prices. We're seeing all these things that would make people think that he'd done a good job. But still, a lot of the media are conjecturing, and a lot of voters have said that Obama was a major reason why the Republicans did so well in this round of midterm elections. But of course, there it's a lot of back and forth, a lot of stuff that we've already seen, but just again, this cover is it doesn't really mince words in terms of the elephant that is now in the room or the Oval Office.
Well, indeed. And moving along finally to New York Magazine as opposed to the New Yorker, what do they have for us this week?
Well, this one is interesting just because we've seen, Jon Stewart has a decent following in the United Kingdom and also in Europe. And of course, he's a late night show host here in the U.S., has The Daily Show. It originally had been sort of a comedy show that has now become a real sort of bastion of political news here in the U.S. And oftentimes, people saying they trust Jon Stewart over other major news anchors here in the U.S., and he considers himself a comedian for all intents and purposes. But what he's talking about in this particular issue of New York Magazine is his new movie, Rosewater, referring to a journalist who indeed was held in Iran because he had done a farcical interview with The Daily Show. So based on that story, based on the fact that this journalist had given an interview in Iran, about Iran, they used it as evidence against him. And Jon Stewart was so interested in that particular story that he said he needed to make a movie about it. And that's what he's gone to do. So this piece is a lot more about Jon Stewart, how he's pivoted his career from comedy into a really interesting sort of the oversight of a very dramatic movie about some really relevant press freedom issues around the globe.
And what kind of tone does the New York piece take with him? Jon Stewart is one of those people where it's hard to say. He does seem to get a very easy ride from the rest of the media, but it does appear just to be the case that that's because he's very good at his job and actually personally quite likable. He's not one of those people that you ever hear bad things about from people who've worked with him.
Well, and you know, Andrew, the article is set up in a way that it's actually a Q&A. So it really lets him sort of talk about, you know, what drives him, also the history of the show, the evolution of his show, and then on to the movie. What also is interesting to point out here is I saw an interview with him. CBS Sunday Mornings' Mo Rocca did an interview with him this week, and they got into the nitty gritty of what Jon Stewart might do next. Well, he's mum on the details. What often comes up is that NBC News supposedly approached him and asked him if he might be interested in one of the Sunday morning political shows. You know, no lie, as a true sort of sit in the chair anchor in a political show, dealing with the politicians that he deals with a lot of the time on his shows. And they also talked about some of his regrets. He spends a lot of time, as I said, talking to politicians, and he knows that in his past he hadn't pressed them hard enough when he should have. In particular, an interview with Donald Rumsfeld, interviews with Catherine Sebelius, who was overseeing healthcare reform. I mean, all these things that, you know, he's done some very critical, crucial interviews in U.S. history on a comedy show, and he reflected on all of that. It's very interesting, a very interesting character, and frankly, I think a lot of people are really interested to see what happens when his contract is up with Comedy Central on The Daily Show.
That's New York Magazine this week, and that was Tristan McAllister, Monocle's transport editor, calling us from New York. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we will hear about a study measuring creativity in the fashion industry.
Every Sunday, the Bulletin with UBS goes behind the numbers and the hype to explain what's really happening in the world of finance. Brought to you from the desks of the key analysts at UBS and experts from around the world, the program delivers definitive insights into the people, places, and products set to shape the week ahead. This is the show that explains how a fast-moving financial world really works. Set your agenda for the week ahead. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every Sunday at 1800 hours Tokyo time, 1600 hours London time, 11 a.m. in New York. Anytime after that, you can download from monocle.com and via iTunes or SoundCloud. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24, 1841 here in London. Now, the impact a creative director has on a company is obvious, but their lives outside the workplace can also shape the innovation and creativity of the brand. Frederick Goddard with the Columbia Business School studied 170 fashion companies, and he learned that having diverse international life experience directly correlates to the success of the company. Earlier today, he spoke to Monocle's Gaia Lutz about his research.
So we looked really at all the big fashion houses in the world, those who actually organize fashion shows in the global cities, you know, Paris, New York, London, Milan. And what we found out, several things, is that one, having a diversity of international experiences is good for you, for your creativity as a creative director. And two, that there are some limits as well. So you want this international exposure, but you don't want too much of it.
Okay, but before we get to the limits, I'm just curious here. How are you defining and rating things like innovation and creativity, especially in fashion collections? Isn't it a bit subjective?
So you're absolutely right. I mean, creativity in fashion and innovation is a very tough topic. So we make a distinction between creativity and innovation. So innovation is basically what is actual product, something that is sold to customers, something that is on the market. And this is what we evaluate. We don't evaluate the process, you know, of creating a collection. We evaluate whether the collections themselves, the real collection, the one you can buy in shops or online, whether these collections are actually creative. So now what we did is like we relied on an existing ranking where they basically ask buyers, and you know buyers in the industry are very important because they are the ones who drive the success. So we asked buyers whether they thought that the collections were creative after the fashion shows. And by creative, we mean, is it novel and useful? Is it an original design? And this design, can it sell or not? And this is, you know, creativity in a market. It needs to sell. Otherwise, it's wacky, you know, it's not creative.
Okay, and can you give me some examples of what companies you found as the least and most creative, and tell me the correlation to their creative director's cultural background?
Yes. So basically, I'd rather focus on the most creative because they are very inspiring. So the most creative right now, Lanvin, you know, the French fashion house, And Albert Elbaz is actually the creative director. And Albert Elbaz is extremely international. Morocco, Israel, France, the US, even other countries. He speaks multiple languages. So that's one example. That makes him creative because he knows how to integrate inspirations from different cultures, for example. And you can see that in his designs for Lanvin. So North African, French, American influences. Now, the other one is well known as Karl Lagerfeld, the German designer, you know, German, actually Swedish. He works on the same day in Paris and Rome. And he designs for Chanel and Fendi, and these two houses are also very, very, very creative. Now, at the bottom is always tough to talk about it. But what we found is like these houses at the bottom are usually they're focused on one national tradition of design. French fashion, Italian fashion, UK fashion. And while the most creative, they usually integrate different influences.
And I'm curious, are there any companies that slip through the cracks or disprove the theory in any way? More national companies that actually did very well with the buyers or very international companies that didn't?
Yeah, this is actually an excellent point. I mean, so basically what we did is a statistical analysis. So we say overall, you know, it's better to have this international exposure. Now, of course, you always have exception, you know, in this type of analysis. So several companies can come to mind, but Prada is a good example. I mean, creative company, Muccia Prada, herself Italian, you know, based in Italy. That might be an exception. I mean, even though, of course, you know, she's also a jet setter and has a lot of connections everywhere. But in terms of her personal experience, she might not be as international as Lanvin. I mean, Albert Elbaz for Lanvin or Karl Lagerfeld for both Chanel and Fendi. But she's very creative as well. So you have exceptions, of course.
And what were the variables to your research? Because can you really consider traveling or being born in places which are mainly Western European capitals, such as London, Paris and Milan? That's different. Is there a lot of cultural exchange when you're talking about? And what if you travel for a couple of hours only for a fashion show? How do you account for this sort of international background, which is not actually that international? It's not as if someone's coming from China or...
Yeah, you're absolutely right, actually. What we looked at in the study is only significant foreign experiences, so professional experiences. Did you work in a foreign environment? And we believe, and we did that because we believe that it takes time to actually learn what is going on in the country, to learn, you know, the ways, the customs, even the language. It takes more than 6 months, basically. So short travels... while they might not be, they might not have a negative impact on you, they might not provide you with the same insight you would get from working abroad, actually, being physically in a different country. Now, what you said about fashion, the fact that, you know, the fashion capitals are Western, you know, Western capitals plus New York right now, is also changing. And you have a lot of designers coming from India, China, Brazil and so on, who actually now make it in the big fashion capitals. And you had the same thing with the Japanese back in the 70s and 80s in Paris. And for them, the cultural distance is relatively high. So it takes more efforts. It's more risky. But at the end, you know, you can also reap the rewards of this huge cultural difference. And you bring something unique with you that you will not have if you, you know, come from Paris and go to London, or not as much.
It's Frederick Goddard from the Columbia School of Business speaking to Gaia Lutz. You're listening to Midori House. It's time now for a bit of music. I guess by way of follow-up to that previous item, this is The Inevitable track by David Bowie. David Bowie with Fashion. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, the best of the week's new books. It's just gone 18:51 in London, coming up for the end of the show, which means it's time for our daily arts review. Today we're taking a closer look at what is appearing on a bookshelf near you shortly. Standing by in our New York studios is Parul Segal, an editor at the New York Times Book Review. Welcome to the show. The first two books you wanted to talk about have a kind of a thematic link, and then they're about mortality and the approach of it. But I want to talk first about Atul Gawande's Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End, which I guess confronts that weird contradiction that, you know, everybody has ambitions of living to old age, but it actually doesn't sound like all that much fun once you get there.
Which is, yes, that's what Atul Gawande's point is, that medicine has done so much to extend the years that we live, but how has it really addressed the quality of life? And Gawande is, of course, this surgeon and best-selling writer, and this new book is both expert and very intimate. He looks at his patients, he looks at the life of his own father and says, what are the conversations people are having, and specifically doctors are having with their patients, about identifying priorities and creating a plan for treatment and lifestyle that can best help patients achieve those priorities.
I mean, as you say, there's that twin track to this. He is, of course, a doctor, and doctors, I think, for the good of their own sanity, tend to develop a certain detachment to the reality of what they're dealing with, but he's also finds himself becoming the son of a dying parent. What does the latter experience teach him about his job?
Maybe how little he knows, I think. And I think Gawande is, and I think the reason that he touches so many readers is because he doesn't have a paternalistic perspective about medicine. I mean, there's a beautiful strain through this book, and I think even when you look back at his books like The Checklist Manifesto, and he says, let's have a participatory kind of medicine. Let's have a medicine where we can sit down with patients as doctors and listen, ask questions. And the best part of this book, I think, is when he actually leads doctors to a bunch of questions that they can ask, and teaches them how to hear the responses without going into prescriptions immediately.
Does he come up with any, I guess, firm conclusions about what doctors get wrong in this circumstance and why they get it wrong? Is it just that doctors, like the rest of us, really don't like giving people bad news, and these doctors are often in the position of having to give people the worst news imaginable?
Yeah, I think there's some of that, but I think... I think he is excellent at getting at what we all get wrong about old age, and not even just doctors, but children of people whose parents are growing older. One point he makes is that we, doctors and children, we tend to privilege safety, whereas the elderly privilege meaning, and they still want to be the authors of their lives in a meaningful sense. So we can sort of guide them towards nursing homes or this form of care, but what they really need and what they really need to have discussions about is, well, how can we still feel like we are agents in control of our destiny?
Well, the second book you've chosen, as I said, has a broadly similar theme. This is New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast's book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, which is a grim subject, of course. Again, it's about someone's parents becoming old and frail and dying, but she's a cartoonist and a very, very funny one. How does she reconcile those things?
I don't know if she does. I mean, I think if you're a fan of Roz Chast, you know that she's like this poet laureate of panic and anxiety and terror. And she has these very sort of distinctive characters, these sort of potato-like figures who are trembling in her panels. And they're sort of obsessing over the minutiae of behavior and betrayals of the body. So what she does in this book, which is, as you say, you know, it's about her parents and it's about their decline, is... I think she's a very, very solid sense of how, like, even in... while asking the largest, most profound... questions, human beings are at some level essentially ridiculous. And I think one's parents, even when one is completely devastated and worried for them, are still this figure of absolute fun and oppressiveness and completely irresolvable tensions. So she gets that down.
But does this work as a work, I guess?
I think so. I don't think I've read a book that's actually more terrifying and more funny. I think her parents are also these incredible characters. They're just this completely codependent couple, kind of monstrous, kind of silly. And she's just, also if you love Chast's work, suddenly you see where so many of her women and her men come from. This couple that haunts her completely incapable parents living in this brownstone in Brooklyn and collecting handbags and eyeglasses. And it's funny. Beside itself, it's funny.
I mean, do you get the sense, and I guess especially for fans of Roz Chast's work, that this is a bit of a Rosetta Stone? You described her as, I think, the poet laureate of panic. Do you get the impression from this book that her parents have actually informed all her other work?
I mean, you can't, it has to on some level, just because they are such bizarre personalities, and their speech patterns, and their sort of, you'll recognize little turns of phrase, you'll recognize a certain kind of attitude. And so, it's lovely to always come back to an artist and sort of even get that sense, however erroneously, that you've discovered their source material.
Well, so. Finally, and I guess a book which may consider similar things, this is the new biography of Tennessee Williams by John Lahr. So you have a fantastic writer, a compelling mm-hmm. subject. What happens next?
Yeah, I think these books are oddly in conversation. They're all about these long, grim declines. But so the Lahr bio is in a way, it has a beautiful premise. So what John Lahr says is that essentially that so much attention has been focused on Williams as this sort of squalid, tragic figure, the sex and the drugs and the madness, that we've sort of moved away from the work. And he wants to bring us back to the plays. So the plays are front and center of this book, and it isn't really a sequential biography. It's more this sort of cartography of Williams's imagination and influences, and what he wants you to do and what he wants us to understand. My feeling is that we have to look at this figure, Williams, who suffered so much but alchemized somehow all of this pain into really enduring art. So he looks at the themes that are constant, he looks at the characters that are constant, and keeps the plays at the center.
Do we learn anything about Tennessee Williams the man that we didn't already know?
I think we do. I think because he doesn't want us to necessarily just see Williams as this victim, we get a larger sense of the kind of strength it took him to sort of stage these plays, the kinds of artistic collaborations. We get a sense of the functional Williams, I think, that we've been missing, in part because of Williams. He wrote this amazingly unreliable but fantastic memoir that I think has colored a lot of the readings of him in later years.
That's John Lahr's biography of Tennessee Williams, and that was Parul Sehgal. Thank you very much for joining us, an editor at the New York Times Book Review. And that's all we have time for, unfortunately, on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Martin Plaut and James Boyes. Today's show is produced by Emily Elias, research by David Pleasant, Alia Massoud, and Benoit Grogan-Avignon, and our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. Next up after the headlines is The Urbanist at 2200, The Monocle Daily with, I think I'm right in saying, Emma Nelson and Nancy Durham. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.